on November 23, 1965, UW Extension Chancellor Donald R. McNeil introduced a very special guest to a crowd of 3,000 people in the UW-Madison Stock Pavilion.
While no one person or one group can take credit for the full measure of these successes this past decade, one may well ask where we in America would be today without the man who honors us with his presence this afternoon. His career is well known. Born and raised in Atlanta, he studied at Pennsylvania, Harvard, and Boston universities. From Boston, he received his PhD degree in 1955. Holder of more than 20 honorary degrees, he is the author of several books: Stride Toward Freedom, The Measure of a Man, Strength to Love, and Why We Can't Wait. During his spectacular career, he has been jailed, threatened, cursed, and reviled on the one hand, praised, acclaimed, and honored on the other. Most men are accorded high honors at the twilight of their illustrious careers, and it is most significant that last year, at the age of 35, he received the Nobel Peace Prize. This can only mean that our honored guest has many years ahead of him to further the cause of civil rights. This can only mean that he shall continue during ensuing decades to hold high the torch of hope, as he did on that unforgettable day in Washington when he told the nation and the world, "I have a dream." Ladies and gentlemen, I present to you one of the leading citizens of America and of the world, Dr. Martin Luther King.
Tragically, Dr. King would be assassinated less than 3 years later. In the nearly hour-long speech at UW that day, Dr. King touched on several issues. Here's an excerpt where he addresses the unfair treatment of blacks by the legal and criminal justice systems, issues that remain today.
In the Lowndes County, Alabama jury acquittals of the indicted killers of the civil rights workers Jonathan Daniels and Mrs. Viola Liuzzo, the spotlight of concern of the civil rights movement has been focused anew upon the problem of segregated justice in the South. In a real sense, this problem is part and parcel of the age-old conflict between creeds and deeds, between the lofty ideals of justice and the lowly prejudicial practices couched in the administration of law. The reconciliation of this conflict between the ideals of substantive justice and the hard facts of prejudicial procedural justice constitutes the most compelling challenge constituting the civil rights movement today. The outcome of the Lowndes County, Alabama cases cogently suggests that the whole structure of Southern justice is contaminated with racism and corrupted by color consciousness. Indeed, it appears to be an edifice that needs drastic alterations and facelifting, refurbishing, and reformation in order to be salvaged. The Hayneville cases are by no means isolated incidents, but rather a part of the blighted pattern of segregated justice, a pattern which has led to the murders of at least 26 Negroes and white civil rights workers at the hands of racists in the last 5 years, in the stretch from 1960 to the present. Of all these incidents, only one of the murderous assailants was convicted and sentenced for his dastardly deed. In similar vein, Federal Bureau of Prison Statistics show that despite the fact that more than half of the convicted rapists are white, 87% of all the persons executed for rape between 1930 and 1963 were Negroes convicted and sentenced by Southern courts. The double standard of justice is equally applicable to lesser crimes as well. And such is the brand of justice impinging upon the Negro. And this is what he faces in his day-to-day living. Once he is arrested, he knows the cards are stacked against him, for he has then to confront a world which is practically as totally prejudiced as it is totally white. The all-white complexion of Southern justice is graphically depicted by Attorney Charles Morgan. His portrayal is written up in the Southern Regional Council report entitled Southern Justice and Indictment. Attorney Morgan, defending a Negro charged with murder in 1963, filed a motion to quash the indictment in which he outlined his client's prospects. He wrote of the man's being arrested by white policemen, carried off in a segregated paddy wagon driven by a white man, and locked up in a segregated jail staffed solely by whites. He was to be brought to trial in a courthouse inhabited by whites, in a segregated courtroom run by white officials, before a jury that almost certainly would be solidly white. If he receives the death penalty, Mr. Morgan wrote, he will then be given a last meal by his white guards, visited by a white chaplain, shaved by a white barber, and taken by white guards to a yellow electric chair in Kilby Prison, the chair being the only facility in Alabama justice which is and has always been desegregated. A button, a switch will be pressed, a push by a white man before white witnesses, and the condemned will die. Being in indigent circumstances, he will thereafter be buried in a potter's grave in a racially segregated cemetery provided by the state of Alabama. The segregated character that pervades Southern justice runs all the way through the judicial system, extending from the lowest municipal courts all the way up to the federal bench. The Southern Regional Council report on justice states that the 28 court clerks and the 109 jury commissioners attached to the federal courts of the 11 states of the old Confederacy are all solidly white and appointed by the 65 white district judges. Through these appointments, the judges build higher the walls of segregated justice. It is obvious then that what is needed is a reforming of the racist legal system of the South in such a way as to effectuate substantive justice within the procedural framework of the instrumentalities of law and order.
We're listening back to excerpts from a speech that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave at UW-Madison in November 1965. In addition to his comments on the justice system, Dr. King also reaffirmed his belief in the power of nonviolent action in the face of injustice.
Let me proclaim here and now that I am still convinced that the philosophy and practice of nonviolence affords a more excellent way to improve the inadequacies existing in the American social system. The method of nonviolent resistance is effective in that it has a way of disarming the opponent. It exposes his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience. It also makes it possible for the individual to struggle to secure moral ends through moral means. One of the most persistent debates of the centuries has been over the question of ends and means. There have always been those from Machiavelli on down who have argued that the end justifies the means. But nonviolence at its best breaks with any method which contends that the end justifies the means. in a real sense of means, represent the ideal in the making and the end in process. And so in the long run, destructive means cannot bring about constructive ends because the end is pre-existent in the means. Nonviolent resistance also provides a creative force through which men can channelize their discontent. It does not require that they abandon their discontent. This discontent is sound and healthy. Nonviolence saves it from degenerating into morbid bitterness and hatred. Hate is always tragic. It is as injurious to the hater as it is to the hated. It distorts the personality and scars the soul. Psychiatrists are telling us now that many of the inner conflicts and many of the strange things that happen in the subconscious are rooted in hate. And so they are now saying, love or perish. And this is the beauty of nonviolence. It says that you can struggle without hating. You can fight without violence. And it is my great hope that as the Negro plunges deeper into the quest for freedom, we will plunge even deeper into the philosophy of nonviolence. As a race, we must work passionately and unrelentingly for first-class citizenship, but we must never use second-class methods to gain it. We must never succumb to the temptation of using violence in the struggle, for if this happens, unborn generations will be the recipients of a long and desolate night of bitterness, and our chief legacy to the future will be an endless reign of meaningless chaos. I feel that this way of nonviolence is vital because it is the only way to reestablish the broken community. It is a method which seeks to implement the just law by appealing to the conscience of the great decent majority who, through blindness, fear, pride, or irrationality, have allowed their consciences to sleep. The nonviolent resistors can summarize their message in the following simple terms. We can take direct action against injustice without waiting for other agencies to act. We will not obey unjust laws or submit to unjust practices. We will do this peacefully, openly, and cheerfully because our aim is to persuade. We adopt the means of nonviolence because our end is a community at peace with itself. We will try to persuade with our words, but if our words fail, we will try to persuade with our acts. We will always be willing to talk and seek fair compromise, but we are ready to suffer when necessary and even risk our lives to become witnesses to the truth as we see it. This approach to the problem is not without successful precedent. We have the magnificent example of Mohandas K. Gandhi, who challenged the might of the British Empire and won independence for his people by using only the methods of truth, non-injury, courage, and soul force. Today we have the noble example of thousands of Negro and white persons of goodwill who have nonviolently challenged the principalities of segregation. Their courageous and disciplined activities have come as a refreshing oasis in a desert sweltering with the heat of injustice. And they have taken the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy, which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the formulation of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. One day, all of America will be proud of that achievement. To outline the problem is to chart the course of the Negro freedom movement for the future. We have come to the day when a piece of freedom is not enough for us as human beings, nor for the nation of which we are part. We have been given pieces, but unlike bread, a slice of which does diminish hunger, a piece of liberty no longer suffices. Freedom is like life. You cannot be given life in installments. You cannot be given breath but not body, nor heart but no blood vessels. Freedom is one thing. It is indivisible. You have it all or you are not free. Our goal is freedom. I believe we will win it because the goal of America is freedom. Abused and scorned though we may be, our destiny is tied up with the destiny of America.
Coming up, we hear more from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech at UW-Madison in November 1965. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing a look back at the speech that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave at UW-Madison in November 1965. In this segment, he suggests that being maladjusted to injustice is a condition to embrace.
There are certain technical words within every academic discipline that soon become stereotypes and cliches. Every academic discipline has its technical nomenclature. And modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in psychology. It is the word maladjusted. Certainly, we all want to live the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But I say to you this afternoon, my friends, that there are some things in our nation and in our world which I'm proud to be maladjusted, to which I call upon all people of goodwill to be maladjusted until the good societies realize. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to become adjusted to segregation and discrimination. I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few. I must honestly say that I never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism and the self-defeating effects of physical violence. For in a day when Sputniks and Explorers and Geminis are dashing throughout a space and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can win a war. It is no longer a choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence. And the alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to a negotiated settlement of the conflict in Vietnam, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world, may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation, and our earthly habitat will be transformed into an inferno that even the mind of Dante could not imagine. And so it may well be that our world is in dire need of a new organization, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment, men and women who will be as maladjusted as maladjusted as the prophet Amos, who in the midst of the injustices of his day could cry out in words that echo across the centuries, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." As maladjusted as Abraham Lincoln, who had the vision to see that this nation could not survive half slave and half free. As maladjusted as Thomas Jefferson, who in the midst of an age amazingly adjusted to slavery, could scratch across the pages of history words lifted to cosmic proportions. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. As maladjusted as Jesus of Nazareth, who could say, "He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword." And through such maladjustment, we will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice. And so we go into the future with the faith that this problem can be solved if we work at it hard enough, in spite of the difficulties ahead, in spite of the problems that we still face. I believe if we become involved participants rather than silent onlookers, we can bring into being that brighter day. And this is why I still have faith in the future. And I still have faith that we will solve this problem. I have that faith because somehow the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We will solve it because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We will solve it because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed earth will rise again. We will solve it because that is something in the very structure of the cosmos which justifies James Russell Lowell in saying, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. And yet that scaffold sways the future. And with this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, I'm convinced that we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up that glad day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Those were excerpts from a speech that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave at UW-Madison in November 1965 to a crowd of 3,000 people. You can find audio of the speech in its entirety at wpr.org/centraltime. Thanks to the UW-Madison Archives for providing us with the audio. We'll leave you with one more thought from Dr. King. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
If this problem is to be solved north and south, in every hamlet and village of our nation, all people of goodwill must develop a sort of divine discontent. It will not be solved by individuals standing idly by the wayside, but by individuals becoming involved in the struggle for freedom and human dignity.